Good evening and welcome to a podcast from the American Academy of Otolaryngology Head and Neck Surgery on an article entitled Sinus Radiological Findings in General Asymptomatic Populations, a Systematic Review of Incidental Mucosal Changes. This article appears in the July 2022 issue of Otolaryngology Head and Neck Surgery, the official journal of the American Academy of Otolaryngology Head and Neck Surgery. My name is John Krause, the editor-in-chief, and for this podcast, I am joined by the senior author of the paper, Dr. Richard Harvey, who joins us from the Macquarie University and the University of New South Wales in Sydney, Australia, and by one of our associate editors, Dr. Jivian Lee, who joins us from the University of California, Los Angeles in Los Angeles, California. So, welcome to you both. Pleased to have you both with us this evening. And Dr. Harvey, I'm going to kick off tonight's discussion with you. In this current paper, you and your colleagues perform a systematic review to examine the incidence of mucosal changes in the sinuses in an asymptomatic population. Now, I know that this topic is very relevant for our listeners and that this can be a vexing problem in the consideration of a diagnosis of chronic rhinosinusitis and therefore the treatment that might be recommended from there. So, as a rhinologist and someone who encounters this problem frequently, can you give our listeners your perspective on this clinical situation and why it's important to understand the context of sinus mucosal changes in this setting, as well as why did you decide to do this paper in the first place?
Yeah, those are all great questions. We, I'm sure, like many ENT surgeons around the world, acknowledge that when patients come to us with CT scans, it's rare that scan done in someone who has a CT scan for other causes for sinus other than sinusitis has a completely normal scan. And I think we've set ourselves up as a profession where we have Lund-Mackay scores, objective findings, and we've essentially made an assumption that someone who is asymptomatic and normal has a completely normal scan in the sense that there's absolutely not a single bit of mucosal thickening anywhere. There's no cyst, there's no little bumps or lumps in the lining of the mucosa, that it must be perfect. And then we do see those scans, I think, as ENT surgeons. But I think we've made this assumption over the last 30 or 40 years that somehow it's only a pristine looking radiology that equals normal. And I think this is something that's been taken on by radiologists such that in my practice, it's very uncommon for me to see a radiologist's report that says that it's normal. They almost always comment on something, and they rarely refer to it as incidental thickening or incidental cysts. It's always some change in the mucosa, no matter how minute it is then reported down as some sort of sinusitis or possible pathology. And so we really acknowledge that our scoring systems that have been done, yes, they have merit in trying to objectify disease and define patients, but a score of zero doesn't equal normal. And I think we all acknowledge this as ENT surgeons, but you know, it's actually the data out there, or at least the synthesis of the data wasn't really there as an easy to reference point for access. And so that's what really drove us to do this study.
Okay, no, great. And that makes perfect sense. And I do really want to spend some time later in the conversation tonight talking about the implications of your findings, because I do think they're very, very relevant for us. So, Dr. Lee, you're also a rhinologist, and I'm sure this problem is something you see probably daily in your practice in California as well. Many patients are asymptomatic, at least from a sinus standpoint seem to be, but maybe come into you with a referral of headache as a presenting complaint. So what do you think that the paper that Dr. Harvey and his colleagues adds to the conversation in this important area? And what was your impression when you first reviewed this as the associate editor assigned to this manuscript?
You know, I thought this was, you know, outstanding review that Dr. Harvey and his co-authors had done. It was, you know, very comprehensive and, as you mentioned, certainly addresses a very clinically relevant topic. There's always been this ongoing debate, as both of you had discussed, you know, about what the true significance of these quote unquote, you know, positive sinus CT findings that are mentioned on these radiology reports, especially in the context of an asymptomatic patient. Of course, this leads to, you know, further questions and discussions about the treatment implications when there is this discordance between these quote unquote positive imaging findings and patient-reported symptoms. And, you know, this is a clinical dilemma that, you know, I've encountered, that I'm sure, you know, many of our listeners have faced. So having, you know, a systematic review like this that nicely summarizes what the prevalence is of such, you know, incidental mucosal inflammatory changes on CT imaging is extremely beneficial to our readership and easy to reference, as Dr. Harvey had alluded to.
One thing I wanted to add there, can I mention one of the reasons for this whole dilemma is that there are other conditions other than sinus disease which produces mm-hmm. sinonasal symptoms. Mm-hmm. So typical rhinitis conditions can classically produce sinonasal symptoms, I guess, as most general population see them. And then, of course, you know, we're all very much aware that headache and facial pain and pressure can be produced by other things other than sinus disease. And so knowing that symptoms can be produced from just the nasal cavity alone, and there's overlapping symptoms with other causes of facial pain and pressure, makes, I think, understanding the relevance of sinus findings even more important.
Good. No, thank you again. And I really do want to get into those details. Yeah, and really think about other cytonasal causes, you know, the role of allergy. How does, you know, mm-hmm. allergy and its effect on mucosal thickening in the sinuses? And is that sinusitis or not? And what is therefore the treatment? So we'll get into that conversation, because I think it is a vexing problem for our colleagues many times. And I think having a framework to think about it is something that's important. Jivian, you were going to comment on that, perhaps?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think it's also important to remind our readership that even though there's this sort of innate tendency or temptation to quote unquote treat the CT scan, that, you know, our diagnostic criteria for chronic rhinosinusitis that has been outlined in our academy's guidelines, as well as, you know, on the European side with EPOS, is you have to have a combination of the objective and subjective criteria. There's a constellation, right, of the four, you know, cardinal symptoms that we have to have. So it's not just a quote unquote, you know, sinus headache or something nebulous. Mm-hmm. You really have mm-hmm. to take, you know, the entire patient as a whole and not just treat the CT scan. And as you mentioned, there's a whole spectrum of various pathologies, you know, that can bring about abnormal CT finds, including just, you know, a URI. So I think it's absolutely mm-hmm. critical to take the history into account, the symptomatology, you know, the severity of symptoms, in addition to the imaging findings, because there's already been established that there is this discordance between the severity of sometimes a patient's symptoms and the actual imaging abnormalities that we see on CT.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you again. I appreciate your perspective. Dr. Harvey, tell us about how this systematic review was done. What were the databases that you selected in order to look at potential articles for inclusion? And what was it that you looked at as specific outcome variables that you assessed in coming to your conclusions and recommendations based on the review?
We first of all, we searched Medline and Embase, and we didn't do other sources, just those two, but they do encompass sort of 90% plus of the world published literature in this area. And it was really done in an era of CT scans. So we did 1996 in Medline to present, 74 in Embase to present. So, you know, sometimes when you're looking at systematic reviews, you'll go all the way back to the very inception of some of these databases. But because we felt CT scans and radiology was really the important finding here, especially CT scans, we limited it to sort of the last sort of 25 years or 30 years. In this, we sought out three parts of the search was designed. You know, one part of the search was designed to find this concept of any form of incidental finding, general population, normal population, a disease or symptom-free population, a negative endoscopy population, a non-sinus symptom, or just all the words that could lead to asymptomatic or some sort of asymptomatic condition. And that really was the population. Now, obviously, when we do searches in this, we sometimes will include studies that maybe have two arms. For instance, there may be an arm of diseased sinuses, but then there's also an asymptomatic or general arm in comparison. So we were open to any study that provided us with that data that we're after, this the concept of what's happening in the asymptomatic group. And then we really looked at both computed tomography, MRI scan, and plain radiology. We left it open there. And then we took any sort of outcome, whether it be mucosal thickening, cysts, evidence of sinus disease, Lund-Mackay scores, Lund-Kennedy scores, anything that may have been interpreted as a measurement of mucosal disease. And this gave us sort of the 1,100 plus titles that came out from the search. And I think it came down to something like 33, saying that off the top of my head right now. And I think 33 included articles at the end of the day. That's correct, 33.
Okay. And could you please then share with our listeners, what did you find? What were the results? And what did you find, for example, on Lund-Mackay scores or on mucosal cysts among this population of asymptomatic patients?
I should just maybe preference then first to say that of the 33 papers, 17 of the 33 were very specific in how they determined an asymptomatic patient. So they either did it with special questionnaires or an endoscopy. So they really went very hard to find this asymptomatic group. The remainder, you know, there was a bit of an assumption of being asymptomatic, or perhaps the authors didn't say explicitly how they did it in their manuscript, but the majority explicitly made it asymptomatic. And there were really three findings that we looked at. One was Lund-Mackay score. Two was mucosal thickening of the maxillary sinus. This seems to be just sort of the one sinus that gets the most measurements. And mucus retention cysts, particularly of the maxillary sinus. When it comes to the Lund-Mackay score, the mean score was about 2. It might be slightly higher in the pediatric population, but it's about 2. And that's the mean. So if you take in a sort of a standard deviation as well, you know, sort of up to about 3 or 4 is sort of where you would expect 95% of the population to sit. And that's relatively consistent, I think, with a few publications that had tried to address the idea of what is a Lund-Mackay score that's normal. And including one of them was EPOS 2020, had in their guidelines, it was a consensus statement. They didn't explicitly cite all the studies, but the group as a whole had said less than 5 was considered normal. And I think that's probably fair enough. So a Lund-Mackay score less than 5, if that's what EPOS 2020 are reporting, then that's pretty consistent with our data, with a mean being around 2 to 2.5. The other way that Lund-Mackay score was published is often a score less than 4, greater than 4. It is tricky. Not all studies have the same threshold, but 4 was very common, at least for a synthesis of 3,500 patients in trials. And so we published a meta-analysis of the proportion of asymptomatic patients who have a Lund-Mackay score greater than 4, and it's 15% of patients. So really quite a high proportion of patients will have a Lund-Mackay score greater than or equal to 4. They're the main findings. I think maybe I'm going to put the cyst aside to talk about maybe later on, but the other one is mucosal thickening. So at least when measured of the maxillary sinus mucosa, 2 millimeters is a very commonly reported outcome. And mucosal thickening of more than 2 millimeters is 18% of patients, and actually in adults, it's 20% of patients. So it's really common to see mucosal thickening of more than 2 millimeters, you know, in 20% of normal patients. And I think they're the two, what I feel are the sort of mucosal scores that if I was to take away from the study, I would say that it's really common to see people who have, you know, a Lund-Mackay score of less than 5, it'd be well within normal range. And that mucosal thickening more than 2 millimeters is there in about 20% of patients.
Okay, thank you. And I think having that objectivity is very, very helpful. Dr. Lee, I'm going to come to you, and we're going to all talk about implications for diagnosis and treatment in a minute. But in your experience, Dr. Lee, as you've looked at these sinus CT scans, do those values align with your experience in being able to, at least at first blush, begin to differentiate potentially normal versus potentially symptomatic sinus disease patients?
Yes, no, absolutely. You know, I was previously familiar with that, you know, cutoff metric that Dr. Harvey mentioned, you know, that Lund-Mackay score of 4, you know, had been, you know, previously used in other studies to kind of demarcate, you know, chronic rhinosinusitis versus not. And the EPOS 2020, as he also alluded to, did show that positive predictive value, I think of about 96% with the Lund-Mackay score greater than 5. So, you know, I think, you know, having that type of sort of mental picture of what the criteria are for the Lund-Mackay scoring is really helpful. I think what impressed me the most though were the findings of prevalence, because we don't usually see that very much. And to have it all summarized, you know, in this review, I thought was really useful. So I think, as Dr. Harvey mentioned, you know, the 15%, you know, have the Lund-Mackay score of 4, and almost, you know, 20% of the mucosal thickening. of the maxillary sinus was, that's definitely a significant percentage, you know, of our asymptomatic patients that have these types of findings. So again, I think it's important to take all of that into consideration along with the symptomatology when you're trying to come up with a diagnosis of CRS.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good. So let's talk about the implications then for clinical practice, for diagnosis, and for the recommendation of treatment. Dr. Harvey, I'm going to start with you. You and your practice and all and our colleagues around the world encounter patients who come in with isolated nasal congestion or with isolated unilateral headache who now have these CT findings and are referred to you with a diagnosis of sinusitis. How do you approach these patients, and what can this review do to help inform our colleagues in their clinical decision making?
So I think Jivian's already touched on this. You can't be treating the CT scan in isolation. You know, it has to come with a clinical history and endoscopic findings and a general feel about what else is going on. And the CT scan, like any diagnostic modality, should sort of increase your likelihood ratio or not at pushing you towards one diagnostic outcome. So I think that's really important that we, you know, I think many of us will admit that sometimes patients sit there and describe all their symptoms. We have a look in the nose, and the minute we see the CT scan, it almost changes our headspace, you know, depending on what the findings are. And I think we're all at risk of that trap. We should point out a limitation of this study. And a limitation of this study is that although we report percentages, proportions, the means, we don't describe the distribution of these changes. So I do think one limitation of this study is that patients who have a Lund-Mackay score of 4 or 3, and it's completely isolated though to one anatomical area, one anatomical subunit within the paranasal sinus system, then this becomes, I think, you know, a much more clinically relevant. So someone who presents with unilateral OMC thickened occlusion and a left maxillary complete opacification, this would be a 3 or a 4, depending on how that's measured. Mm-hmm. And if someone then had left-sided cheek pain, then completely, this is where you could still make a case that a relatively low finding of mucosal disease from these measures still correlates very nicely with the clinical scenario. And this underlies our situation where we have the EPOS classification for CRS has tried to define CRS as a localized disease when it's localized to one area versus a diffuse disease. I think these findings become far more relevant when you talk about diffuse disease. So once you start talking about patients have patchy changes and they come in with perhaps discordant symptoms like facial pressure and headache, and they've only got a you know, 4, 5, 3, you know, Lund-Mackay change, then this really makes me feel that it's highly unlikely that those changes are consistent with disease. And so I think that's my take on it when it comes to interpretability.
Okay. Dr. Lee, give us your thoughts. And again, you've talked a bit about this earlier, but how do you approach those patients who come in, been referred in by another physician, perhaps even from another otolaryngologist, with the kind of mildly abnormal CT that we've talked about, unilateral headache, and come in with the expectation perhaps that they're going to have assigned a surgical procedure? How do you approach clinical decision making, and how do you approach your patient who comes in with that kind of a clinical picture?
Yeah, you know, I think it can be very complex. I think, you know, as we had alluded to, we really have to take the comprehensive, you know, picture of the patient, you know, what the constellation and spectrum of symptoms that they're describing, and trying to match it as best we can, you know, to the imaging. So, you know, I think what Dr. Harvey, you know, had described, like sometimes if you have just a Lund-Mackay score of 2, but if you have total opacification, let's say of the maxillary sinus or a silent sinus syndrome, for instance, where they have, you know, the facial pressure, then that certainly would potentially be a straightforward indication for surgery. If they have, you know, pain in the exact location where there is, you know, imaging abnormalities and that's, you know, failed the trial of medical therapy. Now, the other scenario where you just sort of have these vague, you know, symptoms of diffuse facial pressure and perhaps, you know, some of the ethmoid sinuses, and we have to be very careful. This could just be, you know, an allergic phenomenon, or just maybe a upper respiratory tract infection, as I had mentioned earlier. I mean, these imaging findings are snapshots in time. So we also have to take into account whether they've been on medical therapy in the past, or if they had some sort of acute, you know, episode. So there's a lot of different factors, I think, that go into the decision-making process of whether or not we proceed, you know, with a surgical intervention. But it's certainly dangerous, or rather a cautionary tale, to just treat the imaging findings in isolation and jumping to a therapeutic intervention based on that without taking into consideration all of the other factors. So when we're counseling, you know, our patients, whether or not we proceed with surgery, I think it's important to manage their expectations. So if they have, let's say, this diffuse headache and patch mucosal thickening, and they've, let's say, failed medical therapy, and they still want to proceed, then I just think the counseling at that point is absolutely critical.
Can I point out, you know, I was trying to think of a clinical scenario where this becomes really relevant. And to me, I'm very happy to hear the group's impression here, but it's the concept of patients who think they're getting sinusitis, or recurrent sinusitis in particular. And then they get sent to you. They're often perhaps a young mother of early 30s, has two kids at childcare, and says, I'm getting sinusitis all the time. And the CT scan says, oh, significant sinusitis. And then you look at their scan and all they have is just a couple of minor mucosal thickenings consistent with a general asymptomatic population. This is a real danger group, in my opinion, because most patients, in my opinion, who get bilateral synchronous symptoms in their nose aren't getting sinusitis. They're getting a rhinitis reaction. And whether it's allergy, viral, inflammatory, some mix of that, that's what's going on. And we see an enormous number of these patients getting treated with antibiotics with bilateral, symmetric, synchronous nasal symptoms, and they think they're getting recurrent sinusitis. And all too often, these relatively incidental findings are diagnosed as sinusitis on radiology. And then that's my biggest group that I'm sitting there telling them that's not their sinuses, it's just a rhinitis.
So, and you and I, Richard, were talking a bit about this earlier. How do we help our colleagues, either our primary care colleagues or our radiology colleagues, in understanding what we refer to as chronic rhinosinusitis and what in their mind is their impression of sinus disease? How do we teach our radiologists to use language that's appropriate and not perhaps overcommit patients to a treatment that may not be necessary based upon what we really are seeing? So I'm curious to both of you, how do we help our colleague perhaps in this area?
It's a tricky one, isn't it? Because I think if you want to make a case for surgery, you can essentially do that almost with most radiology reports that come out these days. Yep. I mean, they really err on the side of overcalling any changes in the sinus. So we're really doing it for the benevolent cause of trying to do the right thing by patients, like avoiding unnecessary surgery on people who have either a rhinitis condition, their sinuses aren't playing a role in their symptomatology. And I think we have to cut radiologists a little bit of slack here because, in fairness, they don't have the patient in front of them. We don't often tell them much detail on the radiology report. They don't get a chance to do an endoscopy. So I'm forgiving of radiologists. But I do think we need to perhaps go back a little bit to a time when radiologists were more conservative in their reporting. I think they've gone through a phase where I think 20 or 30 years ago, they were told, oh, you must report everything and describe all the anatomy perfectly. I actually think that push by our profession and people in our profession has done us a disservice. It's produced these reports now where everyone has sinus disease. And I think we need to educate our radiologists that, you know, of the very findings in this systematic review. And I think if you want sensible reports from radiologists, it's incumbent upon our profession to educate radiologists, you know, attend their meetings, whether it be department meetings, society meetings, or conferences, and share the sort of findings and experience that we have and the frustrations that perhaps we see between the discordance of the clinical patient and the radiology report.
Dr. Lee, have you had any conversations with your radiologists around the use of the term sinusitis and the implications of that versus just describing the findings that are present alone?
Yeah, as I was listening to, you know, Dr. Harvey, I would have to admit that, you know, I don't actually recall like interfacing with our radiologist to try, and I probably should do a better job kind of, you know, I wouldn't say educating, but just familiarizing them, you know. But I think that it's hard for me also to I wouldn't say to attribute blame. I wouldn't say it like that, but because the radiologist doesn't have the clinical context, right? So they're just reading the objective findings, you know, of the imaging without the benefit of having, you know, the clinical scenario, the symptomatology. So they're probably not even familiar that when we make a diagnosis of chronic sinusitis, that it's not just based on the imaging findings, that there's a symptomatology aspect. So as I look at this, I think probably the best thing that I could do is to let them know that, you know, chronic sinusitis is a combination of these subjective objective findings. So maybe they could comment on, yes, there's mucosal thickening or mucus retention cysts, but maybe they could refrain from saying chronic sinusitis. And that's something I could do a better job of educating them.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think there is some role to that. And I think that would give us a little bit more freedom to perhaps to engage the patient and that level rather than have to work with a diagnosis of sinusitis that's stuck into the patient's mind. That's, you know, I've dealt with a number of these patients as an allergy clinician, and all the time I'm working to try to get them to understand that the findings that I think they're experiencing are not chronic recurrent, you know, chronic rhinosinusitis, but are allergic symptoms and findings. So I think words are important, and we need to be clear in the words we use because they set a certain expectation, I think, in the mind of the patient.
Well, it's interesting you say that because we acknowledge, just as Jivian's pointed out, that the very term CRS and the diagnostic criteria we put to it is not simply radiology. It is symptoms and endoscopy. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, just as much as we don't make the diagnosis based on symptoms alone or endoscopy alone or CT scan alone, I don't think radiologists should either. You know, I think shifting our radiology colleagues away from calling it a disease and simply referring it as patterns and distributions of mucosal thickening, and these are probably the terms that should be used.
Okay, so Jivian, we're gonna wind down the call now, and I'm going to come to you first. Are there any final words or any comments you'd like to make before we close this evening?
Just wanted to remind our listeners and our readership that, you know, again, there's always this temptation as clinicians, you know, to treat any abnormal findings on imaging. But I think this paper really reminds us how, again, important it is, you know, to look at, you know, the patient care as a whole. I think this has been a theme of our discussion, to make sure that you look at both the objective and subjective criteria when we're taking into account our diagnosis of CRS and deciding on appropriate management. Because otherwise, you know, with such a significant proportion of asymptomatic patients with these incidental mucosal findings, we run the risk of administering unnecessary therapeutic, both medical and surgical interventions, if we just utilize the radiographic imaging in isolation in our decision-making process.
Very well said. Dr. Harvey, I'm going to let you have the last word as we wrap up tonight's conversation. Any final thoughts or conclusions for our listeners on this important topic?
Yeah, I think enough has been said about the concept of understanding that a normal sinus cavity doesn't have a picture-perfect normal look. But I want to go back to the third outcome, and that is mucosal retention cysts. So this actually surprised me. If you'd asked myself or my colleagues, especially rhinologic colleagues, how common is a mucosal retention cyst, I would have said 30% of the time you see a mucus retention. They're super common. But actually, when you do the analysis, it's much less than that. It's only about 14% in almost 8,000 patients, so pretty probably reliable data. A little bit less in pediatric group with an overall result of 13%. But I still think in my mind, it's more than that in the patients that I see. Now, I don't propose at all that mucus retention cysts cause symptoms or relate to causing pathology, but it does open the doors to whether or not mucus retention cysts might be associated with things like allergy. And therefore, we do see them more prevalently as ENT surgeons and rhinologists. And so that'd be my final takeaway. Mucus retentions are super common. They are there, but perhaps not as common as we think they are. And maybe there is some association there with the other conditions that we treat in the nose.
And an opportunity for future research, it would seem then. So, you know, thank you for pointing that out. It does sound like we may need to understand these cysts a bit better as well. So this will conclude our podcast on sinus radiological findings in general asymptomatic populations, a systematic review of incidental mucosal changes. My name is John Kraus, Editor-in-Chief, and I would once again like to thank our participants, Drs. Richard Harvey and Jivian Lee. I encourage you to read the full article in the July 2022 issue of Otolaryngology Head and Neck Surgery, also found online at www.otojournal.com. Thank you very much, and we look forward to having you join us again for a future podcast.